Welcome to the Free Cities Podcast. My name is Timothy Allen, and this is the official podcast of the Free Cities Foundation. Hello, and welcome to episode number 15 of the Free Cities Podcast. Now, before I talk about today's episode, did you see the news? Liberty in Our Lifetime, which is our unique and inspiring conference, is back in 2023. Now confirmed in Prague again on Saturday the 14th and Sunday the 15th of October 2023. This year we listened to what you said and we've moved the venue to one in the centre of the city. It's called Empire Hall, and I've been there to see it myself, and all I can say is it's an awesomely beautiful piece of Art Deco magnificence. This year we're building on last year's exceptional turnout, and we'll be making it another truly memorable gathering of the tribes. So put those dates in your diary, 14th and 15th of October. Plus, if you can, add a few days either side if you can spare them. Prague's an awesome city, and I think there's no better place in the world to network and get to know your fellow freedom lovers. Anyway, back to today's show. It's a conversation with a gentleman by the name of Premisil Bosak. Now, Premisil is the founder of a new dispute resolution platform by the name of Disputio. That is an obvious fit with people like me who would prefer to bear the responsibility of resolving their own disputes. In this conversation, we discuss the platform and how it works, as well as a little about the history and evolution of law, including bottom-up solutions to legal problems. Premisil is an anarcho-capitalist, so we also discuss anarchy and voluntarism, as well as transhumanism, epistemology, and the resurgence of personal responsibility in contemporary culture. Now, this is my fifth interview from our series recorded in Prague. Coming up will be three more touching on subjects ranging from world schooling to libertarian art. And in one episode, I talked to a family who, amongst other things, have just purchased a property in a free city in Honduras. Anyway, thanks for listening to these conversations. It's very heartening to see the number of subscribers going up steadily each week, which makes me happy that our movement is gaining momentum. Please don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review, and thanks in advance for both of those things. In the meantime, just sit back and relax and enjoy my conversation with Premisil Bosak. Before we get on to Disputio, which is the platform you've invented, which is a dispute resolution platform, that's correct.
Yeah.
A private dispute resolution platform.
Yeah, so I would say maybe peer-to-peer.
Okay. So theoretically then, I'm gonna think out loud here. Mm-hmm. A private dispute resolution platform is a way of replacing the state courts with a resolution platform. Is that loosely speaking what it is?
I would rather say that it's complementary at the moment because we cannot replace the state court system. But there are loads of people who are not served with this current state judicial system, because the state judicial system is very complicated, and the way how the laws are created, it's from the top down, it's not from the bottom up, so they are not usually related to the practical problems people deal with. So there are loads of people who are simply not served, and there are people who just rather decide to, you know, break up the relationships and the company, you know, move from their troubling neighbor rather than try to find some resolution through the court, because it can take ages, it can be really expensive. And also I think that there are situations, for example, I dealt with one of those, when we can cooperate with the standard legislation, standard judicial system, that for example we were selling one half of the company, and it took us like 6-9 months to reach an agreement, you know, how we will do it. And it was quite painful, and I think for this, and then we went to the lawyer, who then you know, prepared all the necessary documentation for this. So I think, for example, this is the phase where you can use Disputio, you know, to come to an agreement on the main point, and then, you know, once you prepare those, you can then move to the lawyer, who can then create an document.
Would you, I mean, look, thinking long term though, before we go into the nuts and bolts of how a dispute platform works, which is also obviously very relevant to the Free City model, because in the Free City model you have a private ownership of the city, so you're looking to employ different, you know, and different organizations to deal with all these different things. Is the long term idea that it might replace the state judicial system completely?
It would be like a really, really long time, because, you know, it's like the same as, you know, Bitcoin, for example. Can it replace fiat system? You know, I don't know, maybe, but it's like really a long term. It's like with basically everything, you would like to replace the state services with some private ones. I think better thing is to look at it is, you know, be able to opt out, you know, not to replace them, but to be able to use them and to be recognized. You know, you can use fiat and you can use Bitcoin as well, and then you can use, you know, state judicial system and Disputio as well.
Do you, I'm probably jumping way ahead of myself here, because I'm thinking all these things now already, like, I agree, opting in would be good, right? But what about if you decided to go to a private dispute platform to solve a problem that the state thinks they should solve? Is that something that can happen?
Yeah, I guess so. But yeah, you are on the weaker side, much, much weaker side. So it's always the state who prevails and who is stronger. So, you know, it's the battle you shouldn't be in, I think.
Right. So what Disputio represents at the moment is an alternative to deal with a certain section of dispute resolution. And you've got to start somewhere. So why not start with the things that people can actually use it for currently?
So the idea was to introduce to people something that it's quick, cheap, effective, and then that actually can bring results that are better than the results from the standard judicial process. Because if you go to the court today, you know, it's usually the battle, and then there is one winning and one losing. Like vast majority of those cases would end win lose, but I would like to introduce and explain to people that that's not always necessary, and that there are situations where you can both be better off, or at least, you know, you can both agree that this resolution is acceptable for both of you, and this type of resolution, this type of decision, does not prevent you from continuing in your relationships. For example, if you battle with your, you know, business partner and then you end up win lose, the further continuation in your cooperation is probably not possible. But if you go through this system and then you find something that is acceptable for both of you, your business is not threatened. You know, you can continue, or you can continue with your, you know, private relationships. You can live next to your neighbor and not be, you know, not threatening each other. So I think that this approach is better for the long-term relationship, and it can even strengthen the relationship. Because if you are in a troubling situation and you found out the way out of it with your own help, and you know how to structure the argument, how to structure the process, it's a prevention for the future disputes, and you know that, okay, if something similar happens in the future, we know how to deal with it.
Why do you think the current system we have then tends to result in a win-lose Why do you think, is that something that's happened naturally? Incentives have caused people to arrive at this system where there should be a winner and a loser?
I think it has a very long historical roots. I studied some history of law and judicial systems. One of the best books I've read on this was Bruce Benson's The Enterprise of Law. And it's very nicely explained how this happened. That, you know, there were systems in the history which were called customary law systems, when the rules, basically, what are the laws for? They are to prevent first to some disputes and to help you to resolve them. And originally, those laws were not induced from some powerful minority like today's, but they were created from bottom up by the people. You know, they had a dispute, they found the solution, so they said, okay, let's write it down, and we can use it as a rule. It's called natural law system. And in those periods of time, the people not only created or participated in those creating those laws or rules, but they also enforce them. And the most powerful way how to enforce them was ostracism, not like today's violence. Policeman comes to you and force you to obey, but people simply refused to cooperate if you didn't follow the rules they designed. So, and it was so powerful that it worked nicely. For example, merchant law system in medieval Europe was like just flawless, and it was very effective. It was quick, and people use it voluntarily. And you wouldn't use something voluntarily if you don't think it's fair. So it was fair.
So you begin with an opt-in system of rules. Mm-hmm. You begin with an opt-in system which creates rules, mm-hmm. which from the bottom up, mm-hmm. but then they are enforced from the top down, and that's when it moves towards a win-lose situation. Would that be right?
I think I forgot next step. Next step was that when the powerful dead times recognized that, to resolve disputes is a very good business, and they grab the power, and dukes, kings, and all the powerful, then they simply moved this system under their wings, and they said, okay, from now on we are the only powerful minority who will decide. And it step by step moved towards the authoritarian law systems we are now living in, basically all around the world. And since this was authoritarian, then the laws were created by the parliament and or kings then, those laws were not created as a working solution, but they were created usually by some through the influence of some powerful companies, some powerful people, then some nobility or something. And it lost the connection to the practicality of the situation, and it was no longer voluntary.
But okay, if it was inherent in that system, have you wondered whether in a new platform like your mm-hmm. like Disputio that would evolve the same way? And is that likely?
Oh, I cannot I cannot see probably that long term to the future, but yeah, it's possible. But I can remind people that the system can work differently, and that there were times when it worked, and but I think that it must be practical so for the people to use it. So if they see that it works for them and it's better, and it can really prevent the reoccurring of the old wrongdoings, and it can really help them to live better life, they will see it as a practical solution. But yes, the thing is that I try to really focus on the that if you come to an agreement, it's up to you to fulfill it. And you will fulfill it only if you find it good for you, if you find it helpful for you. So I think if you really focus on this voluntary approach, then it can stay like that. But I cannot imagine, for example, at the moment, replacing criminal law system, because that's completely different. You know, I can imagine as a voluntarist, I can imagine how it can work in the free society, but I can imagine how to introduce it now. Now we can only focus on the civil disputes where both only civil disputes when both parties agree to come to an agreement, because there are lots of civil disputes when, like, say, one party feels wrong. And one party feels okay, nothing happened. Then also that's difficult to bring those to the table. But I can in those situations, I can imagine, you can find the motivations for the one who wronged him, for the one who wronged the other party, to bring him to the table, but not in a criminal.
Okay, what I'd like to do is give you an example of a dispute, and mm-hmm. I'd like you to tell me how mm-hmm. the platform would work. Before yep. we do, though, mm-hmm. Just out of interest, mm-hmm. do you believe that everything could be replaced by the private sector? Is that your own personal belief?
Yeah, I'm anarcho-capitalist, so I believe that everything can be voluntary.
It can. Uh-huh. So really, obviously... If you're still alive in the future uh-huh. of this platform, your hope is that it does become a resolution platform for all things. In
yes, it could be. It would be great. But
it would be interesting. Uh-huh. I mean, I haven't. This is the first time I've ever thought about it. But it would be interesting to imagine how, like you say, mm-hmm. the criminal side of things. Mm-hmm. Would it be like an algorithm would be judging?
I don't think algorithm can make a lot of help here, because you need a person in when dealing with people. It's like you cannot replace psychologist or therapist with algorithm. It's the basically same here, You are dealing with people, with people's emotion. You need to show them that you understand them, you accept them. And it's not something you can code.
Really? Yeah. Even 100 years of AI, you think?
I absolutely don't think it can happen.
Well, that's good. Interesting. I don't know, but I would posit that mm-hmm. it would have to be true that in 500 years, mm-hmm. AI would be able to mimic... Like with access to the information of what humans have done for so long, it would be able to predict what was right and wrong. I don't know. I can't say for sure, but it would make sense to me if it did.
I think it can decide even now what's right and wrong, but it's not enough. You have to communicate with people. You have to show them empathy. You have to lead them. You have to be kind, and that's things that I think cannot be offloaded to AI. Right and wrong is quite simple, actually. There are objective philosophical approaches where you can decide whether it's something wrong, right and wrong. But yeah, unfortunately, it's not serious.
Okay, let's let me try an example then. I'll use the example we were just talking about at breakfast. Mm-hmm. I live in a flat, mm-hmm. and I have insurance on my flat. Mm-hmm. Obviously, some water starts dripping down from above. Mm-hmm. Somebody somewhere above me has got a problem, mm-hmm. and I decide to take the issue to disputio. Mm-hmm. The first thing is, and we spoke about this briefly already, if I first have to go to my neighbor and say, mm-hmm. would you sign up for this platform? Mm-hmm. That's already a kind of a barrier to entry for me.
Yeah,
is that
sure.
How does that
it
work?
It is, because no one knows about this video.
Right, yes.
So the first thing for us to build the brand, so people recognize us and they know, okay, there is something like this, there is this possibility. For now, you would need to go then and explain what the platform is about, so that it's voluntary, and then, before you... first, you would need to tell him, you know, I would like to, you know, deal with this, you know, I don't want to just leave it to some third party because, you know, we are neighbors. I would like to get along with you well in the future. And I think that's important that if something like this happen, we are able to solve it on our own or with some little help, but we will be the one who will create the agreement, not someone else. And then tell him, you know, there is something like this PTO where we can both voluntarily can come, and there is someone who I don't know because that's everything is anonymous. We both of us will be anonymous there, and we can't at the moment choose who will help us. There will be some anonymous guide, mediator, who will walk us through, and he will help us find some common ground how to resolve this. And I think if we manage to come to some agreement, it will help us in the future to be good neighbors.
Right. So as part of this system, mm-hmm. is there a way of verifying the trustworthiness of Disputio? How do I say, I mean, mm-hmm. let's imagine this is a real case, you mm-hmm. know. I mean, another thing I just thought about was probably, obviously, I will try and negotiate with my neighbor myself first.
Sure, knock on the door. Always the first step.
Say hello, okay. And, you know, can mm-hmm. you, mm-hmm. but then if we're taking it to a dispute resolution, mm-hmm. there's probably already a bit of a problem, isn't there?
Yeah, there's some emotions involved, you know. And sure.
Right. So is there any system, like part of the system, mm-hmm. to rate the trustworthiness of mm-hmm. Disputio? I mean, presumably, if there were a number of choices, mm-hmm. I could say, right, here are the resolution platforms. Mm-hmm. Which one shall I choose? There'll be aggregators that'll say, right, here are the most trustworthy ones.
Like, yeah.
Any others at the moment?
I don't know about them. And I think, we have to build the brand, and we have to build the reputation. That's like every other service in the world. And now we are running on the first layer of the application, where everything is for free, and the people on the receiving end, those who will help you, they do it just voluntarily for free to get the expertise, you know, to get training. Some of them are professional, some of them are just, you know, starting the mediation thing. And in the future, we will introduce a paid version where you can, choose the concrete mediator or guide. We call them guides. And there will be a reputation, you know, how many cases they were involved in, you know, how many of those cases they brought to an agreement. So you can then, and then, for example, what are they focusing at, if it's family or business related disputes. And then you can, you know, see their, and of course, there is reputation from those they helped. So you can see, you know, how many stars they have, you know, how many cases they have, and then you can decide which one you would like to help.
Okay, so I've managed to persuade my my neighbor to sign mm-hmm. up. Mm-hmm. What happens now? Like mm-hmm. literally, like what does the website look like? What is mm-hmm. is it an app or a website? Or
it's an Android app and a website. So the procedure is like that. Okay, you agreed. You already have his. You either already have his email address, or he will give you, and you will send an invitation. Where you in this invitation, you can describe what's going on, and that you would like to search help from this PTO. And in this invitation, there is already described what's the application about. Then it's voluntary, and then, you know, and that the mediator will not decide for you. It's up to you. You are the active participant who will create the final resolution. And then he will receive this invitation in email. He will click on it. It will create an account for him, and he will immediately be in a chat room. If you both agree to use Disputio, then this case will appear to our guides, and they will all receive an email. Okay, there is a new case for you waiting, and they look at it and say, okay, I would like to help. So they say, okay, the case is mine, and now you will receive an alert, an email, where it said, you know, this guy is your guide, is your mediator, and he will help you walk you through the whole process. And everything is chat only, that I haven't mentioned it, I think. So it allows us the anonymity. So everyone is under the digital handle, and it's text only, and it allows us to talk asynchronously. So, you know, whenever you have time, you can write down in a chat. You can agree to meet at some agreed time to be all in, so you can react on each other's messages, or you can think through. Usually, up until now, our experience is that people in those cases usually need time to think through those posts. So it's not like instant messaging. It's just like it's usually longer posts which people think through. So the asynchronicity, I think, is a good thing. So you even for the guides, you can use your time effectively when you have time. The guide we created a manual or curriculum with the help of professionals that divides the process of dispute resolution in several phases. Every guide has this curriculum at hand when dealing with disputants, and he can anytime peep there and then see, okay, I'm in this phase, the goal in this phase is this, I need to find the interests or hidden interests, and then match those interests, which one of those are competing interests, and then there are several phases, and then he will walk you through this whole process and help you to really get to the root cause.
In the mediators, is there any algorithmic part or technological part, or are the mediators just people who are trained in a specific set of ways?
Yes, these are just people. No algorithm there. The only technological thing we bring is that secure chat and we try to offer the guides that
so out of interest place, then uh-huh. What's the one thing that occurred to me was if I was trying to resolve a dispute using chat, it would necessarily remove much of the emotional part from it, because face to face, with a mediator, yes, people get heated, mm-hmm. So, which is obviously a good thing. Because I'm trying to work out, why would I not just go to a mediator and sit in an office? I know it's less convenient. You have to be there.
That's another thing. We are one click away. It's free. You don't need to search, where the mediator is, to arrange the meeting. You just click there and you are immediately there. You can immediately start. You don't need to arrange meeting. You can be there when you want. That's one thing. Also, that the text version helps people to calm down and some people are afraid actually to come face to face, and then that's one of the burdens that prevents them from dealing this. And I think that the text approach also can help them to overcome this burden.
I think also texting would necessarily bring out a much harsher element of truth. I mean, look at how people are online on Twitter versus how they are in real life. They're more cutting. They're more, and I think, certainly, if you can sit and digest what someone has said to you, so they're like, oh, they're just dripping on my head and the dog's running around barking and blah, blah. If they were in front of you, you'd get quite upset about that. But if you read it through, you could read it, go away, come back, read it again, go away.
And the mediator should help you, when accepting the emotions, he doesn't need to agree with those, but he needs to accept them, and it helps you really to calm down. And, okay, there is a reason why I feel like this. It doesn't mean it's reasonable, but there is a reason. Okay, we accept.
Who came up with your training strategy then for mediators?
I created everything. So, I asked for the help from the professional guy who has 30 years in practice in mediation and who helped me with creating the manual and organizing the training. And he trained first a batch of the mediators. But as I mentioned, later professional mediators came to me and they registered within the system. So they would like to have some feed of the cases because there are not that many of those.
And I'm assuming the whole system is pretty decentralized. Mediators can be anywhere, anytime.
Anywhere, anytime. And anyone basically can become a mediator. I don't ask for any education or anything, just if you are willing to help and if you are willing to study the necessary theory, then you can become a mediator.
And how do you know if they're good enough though? How do you test them?
Will tell.
Oh, you mean the rating system?
If they get like some bad reputation and people complain about them, then you know we can talk together. You know what the problem is, and sort it out.
But I mean, presumably you'll have some kind of vetting process in the first instance. Of the mediators, I mean.
I can kick you off the platform,
yes,
of course.
Yeah.
But it's the last thing I would like to do. I would first talk to them, you know, is there any problem? You know, why are you doing this? Why are those complaints there? And
so do you think the mediation role is relatively simple to do?
It's very simple. You mean in the application?
Yeah. Well, yeah. As a mediator, I mean, like... If I had no experience of mediation, mm-hmm. and I came onto that platform, could I learn to be a mediator pretty easily?
At the moment, I do it manually on my own. So we will call, we will have a meeting, online meeting or live meeting, and I will explain to you what the application is about. I will show you the curriculum. I will ask you to go through the curriculum. And then if anything is unclear, we can do the training for you. I can show you some examples. I cooperate with one guy who is providing mediation online courses. So you can go there. So it's up to you. But it's quite simple.
It's, I mean, I'm understanding it now. It's, mm-hmm. it's the kind of Uber method of mediation, isn't it?
Yeah,
it is. Well, it's the same.
Sort of, yeah.
Bolt. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can choose to. Both sides of the mm-hmm. of the equation are mm-hmm. are coming voluntarily, and mm-hmm. and I mean, if it's it'd be brilliant. And I mean, I know a lot of people that really enjoy mediation, like who aren't mediators. The process of mediating, there are certain people with certain temperaments for whom that would be a very rewarding experience. I'm sure.
I think so, but it's like. There are only a tiny fraction of civil disputes come to mediators nowadays. For example, I saw some statistics here in the Czech Republic, and there is 400,000 civil disputes in front of the courts a year, roughly. And 3,000 of those end up in mediation. You know, but it's like, I mean... They are sent to the mediator by the judge. Of course, there are some mediation cases which doesn't go through the judicial system, so we can maybe double it. But it's still like tiny fraction of the disputes end up in the mediation. So I think that there's a big potential to introduce this possibility to people, because I think that the problem is that loads of people simply doesn't know what the mediation is about, that there is something like this, because we were mostly raised up, I think, in authoritarian way, you know, just look at how many people still hit their kids. Mm. And that's what's in our roots. And we are used to just, if you have a problem, okay, ask someone else to decide, you know. First, it was parents, then, you know, teacher, then the manager at work, you know, just, you know, I don't want to be in it. It's unpleasant for me to deal with him. Just please decide and say who is wrong, who is good. And that's what we talked about at the beginning. That's also a very important part, that we are not taught how to structure an argument, how to negotiate, and that's missing. So that's again the reason why people just rely on the third person to.
So you, I'm sure you very much think of this platform as a as one that would empower the individual. It's certainly
absolutely.
Yeah, that's interesting. Because
but you need to do. I'm sorry.
What I was going to say was, mm-hmm. listening to you talk about the 400,000 civil, mm-hmm. And hardly any of them going to the dispute resolution. Mm-hmm. I've got two questions. There is number. Well, firstly. Do you happen to know what the main civil dispute is? Do you know what the most common thing is?
Let me remember. Yeah, there was a breakdown of this. I think the divorces.
Divorces.
That's divorces and contract disputes.
Right.
Yeah.
So on your actual platform, which is running and working now, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yes, it is.
Have you had some divorces on your platform?
Yes, most of the cases we had only a few. We started in the autumn last year, and we haven't done much marketing yet. We had only relationship related cases. Yeah, some of them were divorces.
Okay, and the other thing which I forgot to ask earlier in the process of the dripping water coming through my roof is. When I reach a resolution with my neighbor, mm-hmm. how is it enforced, or is it up to us to just enforce it ourselves?
Since you are the one who will create the agreement, you and your neighbor, you are the one, and you both have to agree to this agreement.
Is it a legal document, though? Am I creating? Or?
It's not, but you can, since you both agreed to follow this, you can somehow bring it to the court. I'm not absolutely 100% sure how it works, but I read somewhere that it's to some degree it can be used as a legal document, but I don't see it that way. You know, since you both agreed and you found this solution acceptable for both of you, then you are voluntarily, you know, going through it because it's better for you. So the aim is to find something that is better for both of you. Then, okay, why would I use the, something else than if we found a solution that is better for us? So that's the aim that we would like to, you know, the goal we would like to aim at.
So then my second question mm-hmm. from earlier about the 400,000. Mm-hmm. You're saying that the reason why so few of those cases actually go to dispute resolution is simply the culture in which we live, where mm-hmm. we are taught from a young age to offset our responsibility of those things on someone mm-hmm. else.
Yeah, that's what I think.
Yeah.
That's we mentioned the history, and this is, I think, one of the root causes why people are offsetting it.
Yeah, I mean,
and people don't know about this, so that's why we now trying to focus on educational marketing. We shot a video about the video is basically some practical problem in a family, and then we show how the mediator can intervene. So then we explain to people, you know, they have this concrete practical problem, and this is how it will be solved. And that's what I would like to focus now on, you know, to explain people why is it good, what is it for, why is it better, and why they, you know, can
this is me thinking out loud again, but when it monetizes, mm-hmm. when the platform monetizes, will there be a free market for mediators? As in, some of them are more expensive than others.
I think so.
Yes.
Yeah, definitely. The one who is you know, longer experience, which with better you know, reputation, they can ask for higher prices, like in every other you know, business. Mm.
You're a free provided. Market maximalist, aren't you?
Absolutely. I absolutely am. I forgot to mention also that we also tried to bring to the system that the old natural law principle that every time the agreement is reached, we ask the guide to create something we called model case. So he then creates anonymized example that it must be like really anonymized, that you cannot refer to any individual. That, you know, this is schematically, this is the problem we dealt with. This is how I approached it, and this is how we reached the agreement. And then he will save it in our database for the other guides. So then when they, you know, meet some problem that is in the same way, then they can look at there and you can say, okay, they approached this way, I might use this one. We also have a forum when they can discuss together their problems and their solutions. We have an experienced mediator who is working there as a supervisor, who can they ask for help. And through this shared knowledge, we would like to create some like a body of rules or body of best practices that people can use in preventing or solving their problems.
I'll go back to my original observation then, that what you're describing there, isn't that the beginning of top-down rules, which end up with the system we have now? Remember what you were saying about historically? Mm-hmm. Originally, this kind of dispute resolution was a bottom-up, which is what's happening with you now. Mm-hmm. It's bottom-up. It's people coming together, deciding to resolve disputes. Mm-hmm. But the more that test cases become the law, if you see what I mean, like, well, look, 50 times a couple came together with this problem and in a relationship dispute, and they ended up solving it this way. So this is the way to do it.
No. The top down is that someone sit together and out of their head they create a rule. Uh-huh. Bottom up is that you have the real problem, you solved it somehow, and then you create this solution as a rule.
That's the
difference. So we are still following the bottom up approach, and the most important distinguish is that it's voluntary. So if you find this rule helpful, if you find this rule working, okay, use it. If you don't, just don't. And if you think that you can propose better alternative, just okay. But only guides can do this. You can come there and you say, okay, let's upgrade this. Do this. You can change this rule different way. Because I think that this is better. And then people can discuss. Okay, is it really better or not? And then you can create a better solution. So we are still, following the bottom-up approach.
Yeah, I think I was just, my mind was traveling, once again, 500 years into the future. Yeah, which is, I'm here to understand this. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in that theory of the historical evolution of law, and it makes total sense to me. But it just seems like I often wonder that. It's the same with free cities. I often wonder whether the free city model is phenomenal. I really like the idea of the free cities model.
Me too.
But 500 years in the future, how do we know that the free cities don't become states? is this normal, natural ebb and flow of cultural existence or
I don't think so. I think there are certain ratchets that you don't fall back behind again. Look at slavery. Once it was abolished, now no one can you can't imagine someone proposing let's bring back slavery. So yes. I think that once people understand that voluntary organization of society is not only better, but the most importantly, moral, and then I think there is no way back.
I think you could argue that slavery has become more esoteric now. There, as in, is somebody working for a very small wage in China creating an iPhone, is it still a form of slavery or not? Like, it's not, they're there they're forced, in a way, they're forced to be there because they need to make a living. Someone is dictating their working conditions and they're not very good.
You can say that, the necessity of us eating is slavery because we need to grow food. I don't think it's like that. I think even in China, you can decide whether to go to the to work or not. You can starve yourself. Just you can decide. And everyone here needs to go to work. Of course, in more developed countries, the working conditions are better. But I think if you have ability to feed yourself, it's more important on the basic level. You need to have the ability to find work first. because without that you would starve to death without being able to find any work. So yeah, but yeah, depends how you define the slavery now. You know, I used to be an employee, and my effective tax burden was like 70% something. So is it slavery?
Well, like I say, I think, you know, in the old days, you know, you could dominate by force. That was a very common way of asserting your power. Power's become a lot more abstract these days, and people respond very directly to situations like that. Whereas when you control people through slightly more esoteric means,
like regulations, taxations, you know, they control us, of course, through that, because before you start business, you know, you have to go through hundreds of pages of regulations. You have to fulfill that form and that form, you know, you have to report to this agency and that agency. Yeah, that's, of course, that's a part of the how the state controls us, and that's why I'm anarchist.
Do you, well, first of all, before we go on to anarchism, which it sounds fascinating and it is fascinating, have you thought about, you know, doing this in a free jurisdiction of any of the free jurisdictions around the world? Is that something that's on your mind?
Yeah, sure. I think that can be used anywhere, but this is, of course, the place where I think it can start more flawlessly, that the people would better understand what I am aiming at and what we would like to achieve, and people would be more willing to take on the responsibility in those places. So yes, that's I think it's natural that I guess in those places it can be easier.
Well, it's certainly something that more liberty-minded people are likely to choose. Anything where they can take responsibility themselves for the resolution in as much way as possible.
Yeah, exactly.
And obviously you revolve in those kind of circles anyway, I presume.
Yeah, of course. I know.
Talk to me about anarchism then, or what? How did you describe yourself, your beliefs earlier?
I'm a voluntarist, anarcho-capitalist, yeah.
Can you break down anarcho-capitalism for me?
Yeah, that's a philosophy, I would say, which says that it's very simple, basically, that it only says that all interactions between people should be voluntary. That's it. You know, so that's also that you can say it that it's freedom from coercion, because freedom per se doesn't say anything. But freedom from coercion, that's the most important thing.
Why do you think so many people think the word anarchy means the whole system is going to fall apart then? Like, is it because they haven't thought it through? I mean, your belief is if people are left to their own devices, things will work better.
Yeah, I think that, look at the human body. Who was in charge of the process creating the human body? You know, that's spontaneous order. That's the highest level of order in the universe. That's spontaneous order. And that's the anarchy. That's the spontaneous order. And anytime we try to intervene, we just ruin it. That's central planning. I think all people had the opportunity to see about the central planning leads. And so the anarchy, basically, you can look etymologically at the word. You know, it's from Greek, and it says without rulers, and it's very often confused without rules, and which is not true. Of course, there will be rules, but those rules will be those bottom up rules and voluntarily created, voluntarily used, and enforced through ostracism. So.
Just using your analogy of the body as being the ultimate chaotic formation, which I agree with, yes. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, if we cut ourselves, often we will stop an infection with a plaster on our own body, or we will fix a problem we have. So there are good examples of intervention even in this chaotic system. Would you not? Would you? Would you agree or not? I mean,
the whole process of creating the body was spontaneous order. Of course, we there are problems, so we are fixing them. And I'm not saying that the free society would be without problems. Of course, there will be problems, but they will be solved in a voluntary way.
Yeah. What's your opinion then on technology and the human body coming together? Then
that there will be some point after that will technology become like a human,
or maybe mainly the incorporation of technology in the human being. It's top down creation of humans. Like we're doing it at the moment with phones. Mm-hmm. Phones are now an extension of our brain. I, you know, as long as I'm holding a phone in my hand, I have. Mm-hmm. I can know anything pretty much as long as mm-hmm. I'm good at searching on the internet. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, 50 years ago, I had to really struggle to find out, most things. And the theory, of course, is that in the future that technology will literally be absorbed into our bodies in certain shapes or forms.
Well, it can help us, you know, in healthcare, but you wouldn't be able to speak foreign language or play piano, you know, without, spending hundreds of or thousands of hours training and exercising and learning.
Well, no, I don't think mm-hmm. that's true mm-hmm. because already, I'll give you an example. I used to work a lot in the Middle East mm-hmm. with people from all around the world. And one year I had a Russian guy come to spend 10 days with me. He didn't speak a word of English. And I interacted with him the whole time through Google Translate. And most of the time, it didn't work perfectly, but most of the time I just had my phone on and it was in real time. As long as he spoke slowly and, you know, it was quiet in the background, in real time it was telling me what he was saying. Like I say, Neuralink, Elon Musk's Neuralink mm-hmm. is one such thing, which is where mm-hmm. you're pretty much plugging.
like in Matrix.
Yeah, you're plugging uh-huh. Some kind of processes into your brain, uh-huh. and therefore communication changes. You could communicate. I could communicate with you, uh-huh. presumably over Wi-Fi or whatever it would be mm-hmm. at that point, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I don't know where I'm going with this. I just realized that would probably be... a danger in your eyes because it's top-down planning of something that you described as the ultimate chaotic manifestation of anarchy, which is the body, which I agree is like nobody spent... let me go back to that then. Let me go back to your example of the body. Mm-hmm. It's true that over millions of years of chaos, this incredible body formed, okay? Mm-hmm. But also the chaos had huge volatility. And that's what I think isn't right. It's necessary. But mm-hmm. how do you convince people that things like that are necessary? Because that's one of the, when you look at interventions at all levels, economics, mm-hmm. you know, it's all about limiting the volatility. It's all about trying to, I think, possibly coming from a good place. It's mm-hmm. always trying to make things better for those times when the volatility is working against you.
But relative to what? Like, what was the alternative?
Well, relative to the state of not being volatile, or
do you know the term democide?
No,
a democide is the action of violence against from the state against their own citizens. You know, not included wars. In 20th century, I think there is an estimate of 200 million people killed. You know, is this alternative to volatility? I guess if it's an alternative, I would go for volatility.
Yeah. So a plague happening, but I mean, so
you cannot decide whether a plague happens. But I think that if you ask me about the technology, I think that there's the most important thing is that people understand what's moral and what's immoral. And if we understand that there is an objective philosophical approach, how we can distinguish between bad and wrong, between moral and immoral, then, basically we can go from there anywhere.
How do we do that then?
There is an approach, there is the people when they acquired knowledge, the philosophers created something called epistemology, which is the theory of how we acquire knowledge. And if we apply this theory to the realm of moral philosophy, then we can come to those rules. Basically, every rule you propose must be universal. So it must be valid for me, for you, for the guy on the other part of the globe. It must be valid now, in the future, in the past. So the time, the place, the person doesn't matter. It must be universal. You can try it now. You can try it later. It must be still valid. You know, you can replicate the situation later, and it must still be valid. So that's the first necessary condition. So if you propose a moral rule, it must be universal. And the second test is internal consistency. So if I say in predefined terms, 1 + 1 = 3. Then you can say, oh, it's incorrect. There is if you have like theory, and this falls apart on this internal consistency, you can immediately reject it because it's invalid. So the proposal must be internally consistent. That's the second necessary condition. The third is it must be applicable in practice. So if you propose a rule which is just not usable, then you cannot use it. So the practicality is the last part. So for example, if you propose that let's say theft is moral, yeah. So imagine two people in a room. You know, they both want to be moral. They need to steal from each other. But if you want to be stolen from, then it's not steal. It's not stealing. It's a gift. So basically, those two people cannot be moral. So you have to enable morality. You have to prevent morality to enable it. So that's internally inconsistent. So it means that the proposal that theft is moral is not it's not valid.
But doesn't that negate all rules? Like, tell me a rule that fits all those things, that's universal, that's consistent across time, and that's logical.
Theft is immoral. Murder is immoral. Rape is immoral. Attack on other person is immoral. Two people can sit in a room and they don't steal from each other, and they are both moral. They want to be moral, so they don't steal. So that's just a perfect example.
But say, okay, attacking another person is immoral. What if that person had previously, brutally raped your child? Is it still immoral to attack that person?
it's a revenge, of course.
I know. I don't know. I'm trying to. Trying to work out whether you could everything, every rule.
There are loads of gray. The violence is moral only in self-defense, in general terms. Of course, we are humans, and there are loads of exceptions and lifeboat scenarios. You know, if you are, falling from the from window, and can you broke someone else's window to save yourself, to break into his property.
Oh, I see what you mean, right.
And there are loads of this, but I think that if you focus just let's make it simple and plain and focus on those simple and plain things, and then maybe can play in those with those difficult scenarios, we will be infinitely better off. Look at those simple things like taxation. People say, okay, it's necessary, who will build the roads, those obvious criticisms. And that if you say, okay, taxation per definition is theft, like vast majority of people would say, okay, it's nonsense, you are walking on this street. And I would say, okay, so if I rob you and I take your money and then give it to charity, is it still a theft? Of course, if I buy you for something, let's say I rob you, I decide what I will buy you for the price I decide, I will give it to you, and the rest I will give to charity. Okay, is it still a theft? Of course it's still a theft. So it's as simple as that, and so let's focus on that taxation of theft. And if we sort this out, we can create imaginary scenarios like with those, you know, tram and switcher, and you have to decide whether you will switch to one person or it will kill three person. That's nonsensical, you know, scenarios. It prevents people from using the true morality in the real life, because it just diverts you to this, you know, nonsensical scenarios which never happens in the real life.
Just out of interest, do you know what the most compelling argument against the notion that taxation is theft is? Because when you break it down, if you are compelled to pay tax, if you don't pay it, you'll either be locked up in a box. Mm-hmm. So obviously there's something
I would never advise anyone to not pay taxes. Yeah, because you know, you would end up in jail. Of course, I pay taxes, and I would never advise anyone not to do that. But the thing is, talk about the morality of the thing. I think that it's important to talk, especially with kids. You know, explain them. Okay, this is how they teach it at school, that it's necessary. You know, I just saw this presidential candidate giving a speech to people about how the taxation is necessary, and that the hospitals wouldn't exist without taxation. That's nonsense. And then let's talk about this nonsense first. Explain it to people so they can, you know, the freedom cannot be imposed on people. They have to decide to be free. And so the necessary thing is education, explaining, and focus on kids.
Do you have, as a sort of anarcho-capitalist, are there some historical examples of that system that show a flourishing?
Yeah, there are some places, but the pure anarcho-capitalism never exist, like in pure sense.
And
but
why
there
is that?
there were some. It's like, you know, ask, you know, the slavery was here for 4,000 years. Everyone now understands that it's immoral to own a person. Why took us like 4,000 years or more to get rid of slavery? You know, so it takes time. People, we are progressing forward, and there are a lot of motivations to keep it like this, because there are a lot of powerful people who want it to stay like this, who are, you know, gaining wealth from the current system. So there were some, and as I mentioned, like that merchant law system, it wasn't like a place where which was anarcho-capitalist, but that it was within this group of people who were international traders on the boats. It worked perfectly. You know, that was private system of courts, you know, private judges, the rules they created on their own, you know, they enforced it on their own, you know. And if you decided, you know, not to follow the court ruling, you know, your boat wouldn't be offloaded. Okay, so do it, you know, or you wouldn't be able to come to the port, you know. And how can you make trade without this? So the ostracism worked perfectly then.
So you're of the belief then that anarcho-capitalism is something that people just don't get yet. It's not that it's been tried and tested. You know, I mean, let's not forget, people, I hear that about socialism too. I hear that socialism has never been implemented properly, therefore. I have to be a little bit like cognizant of that. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean,
but they are, you know, we can debate like on a practical level, is the socialism possible? Can we, for example, plan production in socialism without prices? You know, the price mechanism is the most important information system we have in the world. It's much more important than internet. You know, there is everything in the price of a good. If it's not, intervened by the government, of course, by taxes or regulations, but there is everything. There is, that famous article about the iPencil. You know, you see how many people you need to produce something simple as pencil. There are basically millions people cooperating, and you all those information from those millions of people, you have in the price of this one pencil. That's the spontaneous order I talked about previously.
So, going back to price then, and the price mechanism being the most important aspect of human interaction, would you say?
Yeah, the most important information system.
Yeah. So I presume you're not a fan of the current financial system it's necessarily sending out wrong signals, isn't it?
Yeah, sure. It's of course. And it means that the whole economy is not working. It's working far below its potential because all those price signals are intervened by distracted by the government, by the central. By the government, I mean the whole system. Like the central bank is part of the government. So the most important price is the interest rate on the money, and then set by the central banks, and that's the reason why we have huge booms and huge busts. Look at now the central banks; they are tightening their. They're tightening then monetary policies, and they are waiting for the economy to crash. How can anyone, be fine with, okay, we need to repair what we have done previously by crushing people's lives? It's so insane that people read it and say, okay, that's fine.
Are we on a good trajectory then in the world? Are we on a trajectory where the top-down system is changing or not, according to you?
It's mixed, but in the long term, I'm absolutely sure that it cannot be otherwise, that we will come to the more voluntary or even free society at the end. But slavery took us thousands of years. Now we have technology, we have internet. It might be quicker. But I'm absolutely convinced that in the long term we are going the right way, but there's a lot of hiccups.
Well, of course. I mean, short term there seems to be a lot of volatility. I mean, on what time scale are you looking at the world and saying we're heading in the good direction?
See the progress. We became freer, I think, and more efficient. And despite all the bad things happening now, we are living in a very nice time and place, and we have all most people have in developed world have place where to sleep. They have heating, they have water. Of course, they are part of the world that is struggling. But the level of poverty in last 100 years declined dramatically. So that's, I think, we can that's the number we can look at.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. I think my issue is with the trajectory that we're on. Mm-hmm. There you go, have some of that.
Okay, thanks.
In as much as even though the standard of living is getting better, which it is, mm-hmm. These technological advancements that are leading to that are also empowering authoritarians. I mean, immensely. I mean, mm-hmm. we've never seen the ability to control at this scale. And it's the beginning, sure. Obviously. It's new. It's obvious.
Internet gave and mobile phones. They gave us a huge freedom, and then of course it can be served as a spying system. All of those, but on the other hand, there are cypherpunks who brought us encryption and who brought us the probably one of the best things in history, Bitcoin. So. They are competing forces, and technology can be used in both direction. But I think, like, if you simply look at the Bitcoin and the ingenuity of it, it's just incredible. It's almost like divine thing.
You think it wouldn't have evolved unless it had to? I mean, it wouldn't have appeared unless, you know, it was a pushback against, that's what I noticed about in something like Bitcoin. It came at a very opportune time. I know that the evolution, it needed the internet, it needed systems, and, you know, it needed, but it naturally then appeared as the antidote to centralization. Think that'll always happen then? Like in any situation, any top-down situation will have its inherent bottom-up push back.
Or it was reaction, definitely. I read, actually, the Bitcoin started in the 1980s when the people saw the potential of the internet to spy on people, and they said, okay, I think that it's important that we talk about privacy. So David Shom, I think he introduced that encryption system, and then those signature, blind signatures, and everything. So the whole Bitcoin was 40 years into working before it was introduced. So I think it was a reaction onto those government forces.
And certainly, I suppose you see Disputio as a reaction to top down.
Yes, it is. It is a reaction. I see something wrong, and I see a place where I can help, and that was the motivation why I created this.
Can you give me the most interesting example of a resolution that was come to? I know you've only haven't been going very long, but do you have? Can you share an example of something which is?
We have already had like a few cases, and
that's not enough.
And I was approached by some psychology magazine that they would like to do some casuistic research, the research on the cases. Not long enough in the operation.
But you're theoretically, that's because no one really knows about it. I mean, I didn't know about it. It's a very small niche market, I would say, at the moment.
It is,
and it's amongst libertarians, free sort of those kind of people, or not?
Oh, I don't think so. No. I would like to show people that it's practical. It's you don't need to be libertarian to use it. You just need to see the practicality, and then it's useful. I need to design something that is useful, and we are still looking at feedbacks and coding and redesigning and iterating. That's constant process, and I try to be better and better, and we will see whether people will appreciate it or not. Of course, it's a risk, it's a business. And we can end it in a few years without succeeding.
Well, I think it relies upon people's propensity to take responsibility.
That's true. But I imagine like 20 years ago, there were pretty much no gyms here in the Czech Republic, or only a few. And now it's quite a thing.
Yes.
And you have to, it's not very always a pleasant thing to go to the gym and to run on the, to the treadmill. And but people are doing it because they found out it's better for the health. You know, it in long term it brings you happiness, and that's the same path in front of me. I think to explain people that in a long term it's good for you to use this approach rather than relying on some other people.
I also think, and I think the example you've just given might be also fit with this theory, but I think personal responsibility is having a renaissance recently, maybe in the Czech Republic, I don't know. But certainly, once again, as a response to the collectivism of the rising collectivism, personal responsibility then also has its, and I'll give you an example. Someone like Jordan Peterson, do you know who Jordan Peterson is?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't think Jordan Peterson would have become as popular in another time.
Mm-hmm.
Because personal responsibility
is needed now.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And you could argue gyms, that's a result of personal responsibility. Who knows? Mm-hmm. I mean, actually going and working out and making yourself look good. It's something you decide yourself to do. But certainly dispute resolution would be much further on along the spectrum of personal responsibility than that. And yes, easy to see that any service that allows the individual, which empowers the individual to take control of something, should see a rise in popularity in the coming years.
I hope so. I think that one of the important messages Jordan Peterson was saying was that if you want to be happy as a man, you need to take as big burden as possible,
yeah,
and to deal with it.
Responsibility, yes, yeah. Carry the responsibility. Burden.
Yeah,
yeah. I think it's actually, I mean, I'm 52. I think that. I don't know how old you are, but that
45.
Right. That's not a new idea to me. No, that was something I grew up. My parents probably installed that in me, mm-hmm, anyway. And I've always thought that something a lot of people were missing out on was the burden of responsibility actually imbues your life with meaning. And meaning, mm-hmm, is the key to have a contented life. And that's basically, I think, boiled down, that's what he's kind of saying again. And I think he's speaking to a younger generation, but it's still nice to see, because personal responsibility had really gone out of fashion for a number of years. It was very uncool to take responsibility. It was the opposite. It was like, you only live once, you know, let's just do what you want. And so I'm glad it's back. Mm-hmm. I'll be honest with you. It's much longer term thinking.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, we're over time here, so I'm going to wind it up now, but, mm-hmm, I just want to finish with one question that we ask everyone on the podcast, and that is to imagine you have a sabbatical away from your life. It doesn't even have to be away from your business, but you get to choose in that year. You have enough money to fund whatever you want. You can do whatever you want, but you only have 1 year to do it in. What would you do during that year?
I am doing what I want to do, actually. And I'm self-funded, and I left very well-paid job in a bank. So I am living my sabbatical now, and I'm focusing on this studio.
Good answer. I think we get about, I don't know, 20% answers coming in like that. For me, that's the perfect answer. I mean, I'm
happy that I'm able to do it.
Yeah. Great. Mm-hmm. Well, fantastic. Good luck with the project. I think it's a great idea. I think it's a great fit with Three Cities as well, because, it's just a great fit with Three Cities. And I wish you all the best. Thanks for
coming.
Thank
you very much.
No problem.